This is Changemakers with Katie Gore, finding the right solutions for the affordable housing community.
This week's changemaker is Eric Price, the president of NHP Foundation, a publicly supported non-for-profit real estate corporation that has invested nearly $3 billion in the preservation of affordable housing. Eric provides the NHP Foundation with over 30 years' experience in the development and financing of affordable housing and community development. Eric, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for joining us, Eric. And let's just start from the top for our listeners who may not know about your organization. Just give us an overview. What is the NHP Foundation?
The NHP Foundation is a nonprofit affordable housing development company. We have a mission to preserve and develop housing affordable to low and moderate income families. That also includes seniors. In addition, we have a subsidiary called Operation Pathways, and they provide support services to our residents. We're a national company. We're headquartered in New York and Washington, D.C., and we have projects currently in 16 states. That's for a total of 61 projects and just over 10,000 units of housing.
So how did you first get started with NHP, or maybe talk about the origin of just how the foundation started?
Well, the foundation started over 35 years ago, and really getting involved in the development of housing. It was really the reincarnation of an earlier entity. And then I would say probably 10 years ago, 9 or 10 years ago, when our CEO, Dick Burns, came, he really made it a strong focus of expanding our growth, particularly in preservation and new construction projects.
So how did you get started with NHP?
I got started with NHP 3 years ago. I've always really admired the work that NHP does, particularly the mission. Most of my career has been in mission-driven organizations, and I had the opportunity. There were a few people who I've worked with in the past who were at NHP, and they felt that the company was growing and asked if I would sit down with the CEO and talk about that growth and where he wanted to go in terms of moving the company forward. And so I had been at an investment company prior to that, investing, that invested and purchased securities in affordable housing. So really, this was just a continuation of my career and the kind of work that I wanted to do.
You mentioned that your primary mission is the preservation and even the expansion of affordable housing. Yes. And you've got 10,000 units already, which is a pretty substantial amount.
Yeah.
Do you guys have a, you know, 5-year plan to grow by X percentage, or how are you guys tackling, you know, the current need versus what you may be doing moving forward?
We do have a 5-year plan. In fact, we just went through a process with several people within the company getting involved in terms of putting that plan going forward. And one of those things was to focus on growth and projects to expand the number of projects we're doing in some of the locations that we're located in. So we have a goal to do anywhere from 6 to 7 new transactions every year. That's our current goal, and continue to try to provide, and perhaps more importantly, continue to try to provide services to those new projects that we move forward with in development.
I read an article that mentioned your affiliate program.
Yes.
That you help faith-based organizations. You're mentioning mission-driven. Talk to us a little bit more about that.
Yeah, the idea of our affiliate program was to begin to partner with local organizations, minority women-owned businesses, tenant groups, churches, who wanted to be involved in development, who are there at the local level, who know what the community needs. Perhaps sometimes they're even providing some of the services, but not the housing services, because they don't have the housing expertise or they don't have the financial means to move forward with housing, though that's a key component of what they want to do. And so we made an active outreach to begin to try to partner with some of those organizations. And so, as I said, that includes churches who we're in conversations and doing deals with now, local minority own businesses, tenant groups here in Washington, D.C. And the idea is not just to have a partnership with a minority-owned business or with a church, and they are just sort of sitting on the side while we do the work, while we put up the guarantees, while we provide the expertise, but it's for them to be a part of the process. I think that's very important for us. I'll have some churches or minority-owned developers say, you know, we want to be involved in every part of the process, from all the interaction with the city, with the architect, the engineer. We want to learn so that, you know, we can, in some cases, we can do the next project without you. We can do the next project ourselves. And I think that's the kind of focus, and those are the kind of organizations that we like to partner with. And so there's a number of deals currently in our pipeline, and there are a number of discussions we have going forward with organizations like that.
So that's a great way of increasing the access to opportunities for groups that have been historically underrepresented, whether it's individuals or tenant groups or businesses. What a launch pad that you guys are making. You know, do you have particular priorities that you've established, or is this just a natural progression that you guys have developed over the course of just doing business?
I think it's become a natural progression. You know, after you work with one or two churches and have some success, then, you know, others begin to reach out. We have a few projects that involved working with tenant organizations. And I think, you know, being able to talk about the success that we've had with other tenant organizations is something that helps form those relationships. The same is true for small minority-owned developers. You know, we've had some success in the past working with them. And so that just builds on itself.
Speaking of working with other partners, I noticed that you guys have worked with Enterprise Community Partners last year to do some kind of a survey across the country involving the affordable housing ecosystem. Tell us more about that survey and maybe what policies or trends that were captured in that.
Yeah, I think one of the things that was discussed, or a few of the things that were discussed in that survey, were really about the shrinkage of resources that are available for affordable housing. And in particular, you know, they looked at reduced federal funding that went to programs. They looked at the suspension of Fannie and Freddie Mae and equity investments. They looked at the change in LIHTC pricing, particularly when the Tax Act came. And for some investors, it was it had less of a benefit. And so pricing went down, at least at that point in time. So they were looking at the various changes of the various programs. And, you know, just if we continue to think about it from the federal level, only at the federal level, then we've seen that there's never enough resources to really keep up with the demand for affordable housing. I think, though, one issue, and probably it's not discussed as much in that survey, but it's kind of alluded to, I think, in that survey, is that, you know, the federal resources that are available to us, they don't increase as our costs increase to build affordable housing, to preserve affordable housing. So when our land costs go up, material costs go up, labor costs go up, the same thing doesn't happen to subsidies. The pricing of tax credits doesn't get higher so that you have more equity to put into these transactions. And that's what we continue to struggle with. And until the commitment becomes that, yes, you know, not only do we have to have these resources, but we have to recognize there are market changes in these communities. And there are pressures now, commercial pressures, that make it more affordable to build this housing, and that those resources need to increase as well. We're always going to have this struggle to really have enough coming from federal sources alone.
We've had a couple of other guests on our podcast from the Virgin Islands and Alaska, and they've also highlighted some of their accelerated costs that they have with building and preserving and repairs. You also mentioned here in rapidly changing markets, we're seeing population shifts. And so for our industry to try to keep up and preserve what we have and be able to even lease up and create new in some of these markets has really been a major challenge. You know, are you seeing any kind of trends that you want to highlight as being most problematic here? Is it the creation of new? Is it the cost? Or is it just kind of like D, all of the above?
It's a little bit of all of the above. Cost has always been a factor. I've been in this business for, as you said, you know, over 30 years. And so, you know, we're always pushing the federal government to put in more resources. And during good times, sometimes you also get those resources from the local government. Washington, D.C. has been a great example of that through its Housing Production Trust Fund. And so those augment sort of those federal resources. When things get tougher, though, those are sometimes the first to go, because locally governments have to use those resources now for other needs that they have. So when those begin to get reduced, then the number of projects that actually are going to happen in a particular neighborhood are also going to be reduced. So, you know, it's a little bit of all the things that you said. I think trying to continue to find creative ways to do this. You know, one of the things that you're kind of alluding to in this project also is the policies that are made locally, and the policies are made at a federal level. And I just to give you an example, a lot of local governments now want to make sure that affordable housing is not concentrated in any particular neighborhood, which makes sense. You don't want to just put all low and very low income housing. You want low and very, very low income families to have access to the same assets and the same commercial opportunities and school opportunities that everyone else has. And so you'll find local governments who have that policy that they want to see projects in neighborhoods that have gentrified or are gentrifying. The problem with that is those are neighborhoods where land costs are tremendously higher. So, you know, the market doesn't cover that increased land cost. The only thing that can cover that is subsidy, either federal subsidy or local subsidy. So it's just a decision that, you know, policymakers have to make, because do they take the 20 million or, you know, 30 million that they have available locally to accomplish that policy, maybe do fewer units, but to do those units in market rate areas, or do they spread it in other neighborhoods where costs are not as high, but provide more units? And it's just a challenge. And it's different sometimes by state, it's different by locality, it's different by funding type at times, if you want to get certain resources. So all of those things are a challenge as well.
Are there some creative policies or creative ways that you're seeing out there, maybe some legislation that you're tracking that are really making an impact?
You know, I think I referred earlier to the Housing Production Trust Fund that they have here in Washington, D.C. That is a kind of a linkage program where you link the growth of your city with funding for affordable housing. In Washington, D.C., that growth is tied to transfer and recordation taxes, for example. So, and transfer recordation taxes are tied to the growth of real estate. So as this city has built more and more market rate housing, which is a problem on the one hand, in some cases, that they are also taxed. And a portion of that tax against those projects actually goes into an affordable housing fund. So a fund in D.C. that started off many years ago somewhere, you know, at about $50 million is now over $400 million. So I think that that's one creative way, trying to find another source. The other thing that I think some cities do, it's leveraging, right? So how do you leverage the resources that you've got? So every city has money for transportation, they have money for park and recs, they have money for schools, but it's not always coordinated how they spend that money. And so, you know, you can look at, we're doing a project in Baltimore, for example. It's a multi-phase project, it's on 17 acres. There used to be row homes on it, but now they're all gone, they've been torn down. You know, and so we've talked to the city about their transportation dollars being used in that. If it were a project that the city had, you know, designated dollars for a park and recs, that's not this project, but if it were one, we would ask them to coordinate that with the project. I think coordinating these resources doesn't put all of the financial pressure just on the housing project, but it accomplishes both. It supports the housing project, but it also supports the larger neighborhood.
I want to get into some of the properties in your portfolio, but we have to take a break right here. So coming up in the conclusion of my conversation with Eric Price, the president of the NHP Foundation, Eric talks about the impact of resident success programs.
I think it's essential. It's something we try to do in all of our projects and what we plan to do. It is one of those costs that is not covered by city subsidies or federal subsidies, but it is essential.
Thanks for listening to Changemakers with Katie Gore. To find out more about Katie, go to quadel.com. That's QUADEL.com. This has been a production of Forbes Books Radio.